My name is Steve Cargill, and I'm from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada. He worked on that all day and then fouled it up. And I want you to know that's a long ways away from here. I left home at about 7:30 on Thursday morning, and I arrived here about 7:30 Thursday night. And I was on an airplane most of the time. Never got lost once. Changed planes about 7 times. Got in a car with Fred at the airport, come into the hotel, and got lost. And he really made me feel great when he told me he was going to be my chairman. And then he told me you were a big book country. And I said, would you mind getting me a big book when I speak? And I see him go down there, and I don't know whether he's going to get one or not, but I guess he was just bragging about that, too. Probably hasn't got one. I, first of all, would like to thank the committee for giving me this very pleasurable privilege of coming to South Carolina. I've never been in South Carolina before. I've been in a lot of places, but never to South Carolina. And I want you to know that I'm really enjoying myself. And I've been watching your committee, as I do at most conventions I go to, and to see how many fights they have. And they've been getting along pretty good. And that reminded me of a story. Doesn't really remind me of a story. I intended to tell it all along. But a story about a golfer. And, of course, in Myrtle Beach, you certainly know what a golfer is. Because your mayor told us that last night, that you have 30 golf courses. But this young golfer, he'd had a bad day in the golf course. And he went into the clubhouse. And he's sitting there, and he's all by himself in the clubhouse, and he said, oh, God. And a voice came down and said, yeah, what's the trouble? And he looked up, and he said, that you, God? And God says, yeah, that's me. What seems to be the trouble? And he said, well, I just can't putt. And he said, well, God said, tomorrow when you're out, move your right hand around a little bit, and I'm sure everything will be all right. So while he had him on the line, he thought he'd better ask him some more questions. So he says, tell me, God, do they have a golf course up in heaven? And God says, just a second, I'll go and check. So he went away, and he came back, and he said, I got some good news, and I got some bad news. He said, first of all, for the good news, they have the most beautiful golf course that I've ever seen. There's nothing like it, even in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So the golfer said, well, what can be the bad news? And he says, your tee-off time is 8:10 tomorrow morning. And that's why it's so important that every one of us get along with our fellow man. Because we never know when our tee-off time's going to be. And so I'm so grateful that your committee is getting along all right. And then I heard another story about a golfer. And you know what? This is sort of a golfer and an Al-Anon, but it's a golf story. About, I don't know whether any of you fellas or not noticed this, but most ladies, especially Al-Anons, they project things, you know? And this guy was going to chair a meeting, some like Fred, tonight, and he was getting all of his notes. It was the first one that he'd ever done, and he was just really gung-ho about doing a good job. And it's, you know, it's about 7 o'clock in the morning, and he's working on this thing, and his wife said, tell me, honey, if I was to die, would you marry again? And he said, you know, he's working on his speech and what he's going to say, and he said, well, he said, I'm only 43, I probably would. And she said, would you move her into this house? And he said, well, the house is paid for, and the way real estate is today, I probably would. She said, what about the bedroom? He said, well, you know, he said, I don't care if she'd like to move into there. It's okay with me. And he goes on doing what he's going to do and has to do. And she said, what about my jewelry? And she said, well, he said, well, you know, if you don't want to will it to somebody, it's okay with me if she wears it. She said, what about my car? He said, well, you know, it's a small car. And the way gas is today, I imagine she'd like to drive a small car. And it's all paid for, so it's okay with me. So she says, what about my golf clubs? Oh, no, he says, not your golf clubs, never, he said. So she said, what's with you? You would marry her, you'd move her into the house, let her sleep in my bed, give her my jewelry, let her drive my car. What's wrong with my golf clubs? He says, she's left-handed. So I would suggest that you ladies don't ask too many questions when we're trying to get ready for a meeting. As I said, my name is Cease Corgill, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm not going to tell you too much about my drinking, but I'll tell you this. I'm not here by mistake. I did drink. And I got here at a fairly young age. And I got here because I had a big mouth. And when I got drunk, I was a kind of an arrogant drunk. And one night I was in a poker game because I played poker as well as drink. And I did a little something like cheating. And a great big fellow who was weighed about 275 pounds didn't appreciate what I did. And we had a fight. Or I should say, he had a fight. He hit me, and I hit the cement, and it was down in the basement of a hotel, and I got up, and he hit me, and I hit the cement, and we did that a whole bunch of times. And finally, I just stayed down, not because I wanted to, but because I couldn't get up. And I landed in hospital, and that's where I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I know now why I became an alcoholic. I heard your Al-Anon speaker this morning, and your speaker tomorrow morning is Ray. He's a very good friend of mine. I've heard him many times. And they're both Catholics. But I'm a Protestant. And that's one reason I became an alcoholic. For you see, I grew up in a Catholic community. And I was the only Protestant that lived there. And I grew up hating Catholics. I don't think too much of them, some of them as yet. But I knew all about resentments before I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. They used to call the bingos in Latin, so I couldn't understand them. And when I've always been a rebel. I was a rebel as a kid, and went around doing certain things that weren't right. Talking about being a rebel, it reminds me of another story. About a fella that, he owned a little Volkswagen. I know none of you people in South Carolina even know what Volkswagens are, but they're little cars. We have them back in Canada. That's all we can afford. But this little guy, a little perfectionist, he had a Volkswagen garage. And he used to be the guy must have been an alcoholic rebel, because every day he used to drive into this place. And this little guy had a line drawn where you were supposed to drive your car up and then talk to him. But this big guy used to drive in every day and drive over the line, and then he'd go and look over the young mechanic's shoulder and tell him what to do. And this used to just frost this little guy. So one day the little guy got so mad. When this guy drove in, he went out and he drew a circle. And he said, okay, you stand in here. I got some work to do. And don't you move out of this circle. So the little guy, the little mechanic, took a big sledgehammer and he started to beat this guy's Volkswagen. Just hit it on top of the car, the windshields and all of the windows and behind it and in front of it, and completely totaled it. And he looks over and this big guy's laughing. And so the little guy said, look, you know, I'm getting sick and tired of what you've done. He says, every day you come in here, and he says, you can't follow the rules. And tonight, he said, I tell you to stand in there. And he said, you know, he said, you're laughing like an idiot. What's with you? And he said, well, you told me to stand in here and not move out of here. And he said, while you were beating on my Volkswagen, I stepped out of the circle three times. And that's sort of how I grew up, you know. Just stepping out of the circle, see what I could get away with. But I left home when I was 16 years of age, and I went into the service. I didn't like the responsibility that I had at home. I didn't like the responsibility of my school. I didn't like the responsibility of my church, and I ran away from responsibility. I didn't know that then, but I know it now. And I went into the service. And I wanted to be an athlete, and I was a pretty good athlete. And I never drank or I never smoked. And that first night went into the service. I was 16 years of age and put on that great big Canadian Army uniform. And I went downtown with the rest of the men and we went into the beer parlor. And I took that drink of beer and then another one, and all of a sudden something great happened. I was what I always wanted to be. All of a sudden I was a conversationalist. All of a sudden someone said something I didn't like and I had muscles and I told him what I had in. Then we went to a dance and I was Canada's own Fred Astaire. And then I took a girl home, and I was Charles Boyer and Clark Gable, all of them put together. You know, the greatest lover in Canada. But the next morning, I woke up down in that army barracks, and I was that scared little farm boy that came in the day before. But every night when we went downtown, I would be what I wanted to be, as long as I drank. And it was beautiful, so I thought. I did real well in the army. I became an instructor. But when I was 17 years of age, I got kicked out of the army. I went back home and I worked in an aircraft factory and I got some responsibility there. Didn't like it, so I ran from that, ran back into the Army. Told them I'd never been there before. And this time I was a genius. They made me an instructor immediately. I got recommended for my commission. And I'd love to stand here and tell you I was probably the youngest officer in the Canadian Army, but I got kicked out before I went to officer's training. I went back home and I worked for a newspaper. Not because I knew anything about advertising, but because men were difficult to get in 1942, and I had a discharge from the Army, and they hired me with this newspaper. And I got a lot of responsibility at that newspaper. And I didn't like it, and so I ran once again, and this time I ran into the Navy. Told them I'd never been in the service before, and this time I was a real genius. I became an instructor in that Navy. I went away to officer's training. I'd love to stand here and tell you that I was an officer in the Canadian Navy, but I got kicked out of officer's training. It seems that an officer didn't appreciate me telling him what to do with a ship. And I was looking out today at one of those big, beautiful ships going by, and believe me, it's a physical impossibility to do with that ship what I told him to do with it. I got married when I was in that Navy. I didn't get kicked out of the Navy. I just got kicked out of officer's training. And I got married, and I'd love to stand here and tell you that I was a great husband, but I wasn't. I came back when the war was over. I became a gunner in a merchant ship. I sailed all over the world with a lot of your boys down in the South Pacific. And I want you to know that I did some work for you people down there. I'd like to share it with you. We were down in Melbourne, Australia, and maybe some of the boys that were there. But you came in, one of your ships were torpedoed, and they towed it back into Melbourne, and we were the only ship that was empty, and they ordered our ship to take your tanks. I don't mean drunken tanks. I mean tanks for the Army up to New Guinea. And we did that, and the Japanese people weren't too fussy about us coming in, and they shot at us and bombed us and everything. But I want you to know that we did it for you. And we got your tanks in, and when we were coming out, our own ships, our own aircraft came out to meet us and to escort us back into Melbourne, Australia. And our gunnery officer thought it was the Japanese ships, the aircraft coming back, so he told us to open up fire. And you have to visualize, here's the captain up on the bridge. I'm in charge of the big gun right down in front in the forward gun deck. For those of you who are in the Merchant Navy, you know what I'm talking about. And we're shooting like crazy, and suddenly the captain realizes that we're shooting at our own aircraft. And he got really panicky. I don't know why. We weren't hitting them. But, you know, as your chairman tonight called me Cease, and I've always loved that name Cease. My name is really Cecil, but I've always loved Cease. And so you have to visualize the captain up here with a great big megaphone. And he screams down to me because we've got to stop fire, and he screams down, "Cease fire!" So I fired. Ended up an alcoholic, got kicked out of the Navy, and here I am. But I went back to my hometown and after the war, and I start celebrating the end of the war and start losing jobs and getting jobs and losing jobs. And finally, I celebrated the beginning of the Korean War and celebrated probably the end of that. But that's about the time that I had the fight and where I landed in the hospital. And I'll never forget that night because I landed in hospital and a little doctor came and sat down. I'd been there 5 days, and he sat down on my side of my bed, and he told me that, "Cece," he said, "we have done everything we can possibly do for you. We've built you up physically, but," he said, "we just can't do anything more for you." And I said, "Well, what should I do?" And he said, "Well, I would suggest that you join Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'll be ever grateful he didn't, you know, say, "Just join." He went away, and he got two guys to come and see me. And there were two fellas that I knew. I knew both of them. I drank with both of them. And when they walked into that room, I'll never forget it, because one was probably the sloppiest drunk in all of Canada. And this night, he's dressed up, and he has a beautiful brown suit on with a silk shirt and a bow tie, and he's clean, and his hair looks good. And I knew something had happened to Bill. The other guy was a fellow I'd been in the service with, and he got into the penitentiary in our town after the war. And he, too, looked different. And they talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wasn't too happy about them talking to me about Alcoholics Anonymous because I was in a private ward that I'd given a bad check for. And I just didn't want everybody in that hospital to know that I drank. But anyway, they talked to me, and they talked loud, and they told me that I had to meet them on a Saturday morning in a little restaurant when I got out of hospital. Now, I had a difficult time getting out of that hospital because of that bad check. And because I was Protestant and I was in a Catholic hospital. And that little Catholic nun wasn't about to let me out until I paid that check. Had I been Catholic, I'm sure she would have made something. You know, she said it's okay. But anyway, I phoned the only person in the world that I knew my credit was any good with, and that was my bootlegger. And he came to get me, and he took me out of hospital. Probably, had he known what I was going to do, he'd have left me there, because I've never done any business with him since that day. He took me down to this little restaurant, and at that time, Alcoholics Anonymous in my little town of about 35,000 was very small. But they all showed up that morning. They had a live one. And I would like you to... I mean, I've always loved nice clothes. I hope you've noticed that. And, I liked nice clothes way back then. I didn't pay for them all of the time, but I liked them. And, but that morning, my coat was torn from the fight I'd had. My shirt was covered with blood, and I was sitting there with an overcoat. It was January the 16th, 1952. I'll never forget the day. And they started to come in, and they talked to me, and that night, then they said they'd take me home, and I didn't want them to take me home because I was afraid what Babe would say, because she was always a little narrow when I was away for 4 or 5 days, and she just couldn't seem to take a joke. And I thought, well, these guys kind of like me. If I happen to take them home, she might spoil everything for me. But it so happened that some of those, this is before Al-Anon, some of those beautiful before Al-Anon in our area, and some of those beautiful gals that had gone to mixed meetings had gone up to see her and talked to her about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll never forget, I walked in that Saturday morning, and you see, I'd been in that hospital for 5 days. Nobody but those two members of Alcoholics Anonymous had come to see me. My family hadn't come. People just didn't care, I guess. I like to think that they didn't know I was there, but I know that's not true. And I walked in that door, and she said, I think everything's going to be okay, hon. And man, oh man, that was good enough to keep me sober, because that was a different reaction than I'd ever had before when I came home after drunk. And we went to our first meeting that night. It was a Saturday night, and I'll never forget it. There weren't a lot of people there, probably about 30 people, a mixed meeting. And I can remember they had a social. And they played this stupid games like pin the tail on the donkey. And that really wasn't my idea of a Saturday night. And then they had a meeting. And I can remember a guy standing up and say, I've been sober for a year. And I sat in the back in my big negative way, and I thought, liar. You know, couldn't be much of a drinker if you can stay sober for a year. And then a couple of guys took me in the other room, old-timers who'd been sober about 18 months. They took me in the other room, and they said, Cease, you'll hear a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. Tonight you probably heard that there's no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. But they said, tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, there's going to be a meeting here, and you must be here. And I'm glad they talked to me like that, because I've never stopped going. That was January the 16th, 1952, and because of you beautiful people, because of a loving God, as I understand, and because of all of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and Al-Ateen, I've been able to stay sober. And for this, I'm very grateful. I didn't want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous because my idea is if Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't that great. But because that little doctor and that two guys came to see me, well, I came. And I'll always be grateful. And sometimes when I'm asked to go, I never turn down when somebody asks me to go to see somebody. It doesn't matter or not whether they've asked to see me, because I didn't ask to see them. They came to see me. And I don't think that Dr. Bob asked to see Bill. I think that Bill went to see him. And I think it's very, very important if we're asked to go see somebody that we don't use that excuse. Well, do they want to see us? Because I didn't really want to see them. I was something, my thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous was something like the three alcoholic rabbits. I don't know whether you have alcoholic rabbits or not down here, but we have them back in Canada. I don't mean ordinary Saturday night drunken rabbits. I mean real, genuine alcoholic rabbits. And there were three of them. And there was Foot and Foot, Foot and Foot, Foot, Foot. And Foot, Foot used to phone him Foot, 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 and he'd say, let's pick up old Foot and we'll go down to the bar. So Foot, Foot and Foot, 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 they'd pick up old Foot and they'd go down to the bar. And one night, Foot, 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 and Foot, Foot, picked up old Foot, and Foot, 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 picked up old Foot, and they went down to the bar. And so they were sitting there drinking, and Foot was talking to Foot, and finally Foot said to Foot, he said, what happened to Foot? And Foot said to Foot, he said, well, he's here a minute ago, but he went outside. So Foot, and Foot, they went outside, they found poor old Foot was dead. So Foot said to Foot, what do you think we should do with Foot? And Foot said to Foot, well, he said, I think we should take him to the funeral home. After the funeral, Foot said to Foot, he said, what do you think old Foot died from? And Foot said to Foot, he said, well, I think he was an alcoholic. Foot said to Foot, he said, do you think we're alcoholics? And Foot said to Foot, he said, well, we're drinking quite a bit. And so Foot said to Foot, he said, do you think we should join Alcoholics Anonymous? And Foot said to Foot, might as well. He said, we got one foot in the grave anyway. When I was half drunk, I used to use five rabbits. But anyway, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and believe me, I had a great time. I was the youngest member. I was 27 years of age. I know that's not a great deal today, but in 1952, that was a big deal. I was 27 years of age, and I was the young people's meeting yesterday, and I could hear them talking, and believe me, there weren't too many people my age. There were a lot of old people in their 50s, for Pete's sake, you know? And I thought, my God, what a man to hear, you know? But I just stayed sober, but pats on the back, you know? They said, doing a fine job, young fella. And golly, nobody had told me that for a long time. And so I thought, well, I'm going to stay here. But the biggest thing that kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to share this with you, is the night that I went there, there was a little fella by the name of Bobby Motherwell. Bobby's now passed away. But Bobby put his arm around me. And he said, Cease, we want you, and we need you, and we love you. And I just couldn't figure that out. I knew that nobody wanted me. I didn't think anybody needed me. And my wife had told me that nobody loved me. So, but here's a little guy telling me this. And I think that's so important. And tonight, before we leave this room, you know, just with the person next to you, just tell them that you want them and need them and that you love them. Because that's what this thing's all about. Is that we, you know, that's what the fellowship is all about. Whether you're in Al-Anon or Alateen or Alcoholics Anonymous, it doesn't matter. And it meant so much to me. It must mean a lot. It's over 30 years ago, and I can remember like it as if it was last night. And we started going to deals like this, not nearly as big, and wherever I went, I got patted on the back. I was the youngest member in the province of Saskatchewan. And the province of Saskatchewan, I want you to know, is about three times bigger than Texas. I just thought I'd throw that in for the speaker Friday night. But I just had a beautiful time. I broke my anonymity to people just so they'd pat me on the back. I usually told people, especially in financial institutions, because I came here, and I hate to mention this small sum in down here in South Carolina, but I owed $6,200 when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. That doesn't seem like a lot of money to you people, I know, but take it back to 1952, before inflation. That's about $20,000, probably. And I didn't owe it for anything. I just owed it, you know. You see, I gambled a little bit, and I owed it to some strange people. And so I used to break my anonymity to some of these people in financial institutions, tell them how bad it was and what happened to me, and here I am, you know, and maybe they'd lend me some money and it didn't work. But they'd pat me on the back and tell me that I was doing a fine job, come back again. And it was just beautiful. And then a terrible thing happened in our group. Some younger members came in. And they walked right by me and talked to the older members. The older members walked right by me and talked to the newer members. And all of a sudden, I became a middle member. And I share this with you because it's going to happen to you. Whether you're an Al-Anon or Alateen or Alcoholics Anonymous, all of a sudden, you're going to become a middle member. And it's a terrible thing. It's just like a hole in a donut. You're nothing, you know. Just nothing. And you know, people talk about the younger members and everything. Don't worry about them. It's those middle members. Those are the people we're losing. If you were to have a countdown tonight, you'd find out how many came into AA and how many's here for 30 years and 29 and 32 and this, you'd find a few of us way up there, and then it would come down and maybe to 18, 19 years, and then all of a sudden there would be nobody. Couldn't have been anybody came in those years, you know? But they're the middle members, and something happened to them. And it almost happened to me. I thought about going out and practicing a little bit and coming back in, getting all that treatment again. But thank God I didn't do that. Because just about then, we had a fellow by the name of Ernie Sear in our group, and we asked Ernie, we have discussion meetings, and we asked Ernie if he would chair the meetings for the next 3 months. And Ernie said, I'll chair them, providing we do one thing. And we said, what's that? And he said, well, we're going to start at step one, and we're going to do the steps as a group, and we're going to go through them in sequence, and we're going to do them. And he said, I don't care who comes into Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not going to go back to step one as we used to do. We're going to take people by the hand. We're going to sponsor them properly, and this is what we're going to do. And we thought we'd humor all earned, so that's what we did. And that's the experience that I'm going to share with you tonight, the experience that I've had since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we took a look at that step one where it says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I didn't know there was a second part to the first step. I found out that I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. I know that doesn't concern any one of you here, but I'm just talking about what I had. I had financial difficulties after I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, well, now that I'm sober, everything's going to be all right. My wife told me that. If I'd only stop drinking, everything would be okay. I owed $6,200. Shortly after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my boss bailed me out, took me to the bank, signed my note. They sent the checks. They didn't even trust me to do that. 3 years, he made my wife and I to sign a paper that we'd never charge anything and we'd pay for everything. 3 years later, he bailed me out for $7,500 because I had an unmanageable life as far as money's concerned. And then I found out a strange thing, and I'm going to share it with you. I found out that financial problems had nothing to do with money, but it had a lot to do with big shotism. It had a lot to do with pride. It had a lot to do with ego, because I was the kind of a guy that if I went and to buy something, and somebody would say, here's a beautiful something for $469, the big shot would say, do you have something for about $800? You know, I didn't even have the down payment for the little one, but I wanted to impress him, so he'd give me credit, you know. And to show you that I've changed just a little bit, several years ago, I owed a manufacturer $10,000. It's not a lot of money in my business because I'm in the fur coat business. But it's a lot of money in the middle of July when it's about 96 above. And this guy's calling me, and he's giving me a bad time, and he's writing me letters, and he's making strange threats like closing my doors. And so I thought I'd better write him a letter. So I wrote him a letter and told him that I was sorry that I couldn't pay him any money. I liked his merchandise, that I'd sold some on the layaway plan. I would like to have fall dating, and then I threw a little philosophy at him. I said if I had 10 miles to walk down a railroad track, it would take a long time. But if I took it a telephone pole at a time, it would even take longer. But I would finally get there. And I signed it, yours truly, Cecil E. Corgel, manager of C. Corgel's Furs and Fashions. P.S. I'm enclosing a certified check for $100. And I sent it away. About 3 days later, I got a letter back. That's when the post office was operating properly. And this fellow, he congratulated me on my letter-writing ability. He suggested that I get out of the fur business and go writing letters for somebody. And he signed it, yours truly, Mo Amsel, Amsel, and Amsel, Montreal. P.S. Would you mind sending me another telephone pole? You know. For you see, I didn't know how to send telephone poles. I didn't know. I was too much of a big shot. I couldn't, if I owed a guy $400, I wanted to pay him $400. I had too much pride to say, here, I can only pay you $40 this month. And I know none of you have had that problem. But if ever you do, I'll share this with you. Please face it. Because it doesn't keep you on the program. I became a bigger liar than I was because of my financial problems. I became a cheat and a thief and everything. And, I went home one day to show you just exactly what I did. I have two beautiful little girls. They were two beautiful little girls then. They're grown up now and married. But at that time, and I went home at noon, and Babe, you know what these sneaky Al-Anon women are like? Babe said, I thought you said you paid so-and-so. The big shot said, look at him. I said I paid him. I paid him. Well, she said, why would they phone me and say that you haven't paid them? You know what the big shot did? Took my lunch. And we didn't have a lot to eat in those days. Threw it right in the sink. Broke the plate. Went and ripped the telephone off the wall. And said, they'll not be phoning you anymore. And went in the front room and pouted. And that's for a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not drunk, that's sober. And I realized I had maybe an unmanageable life. And we went into that second step where it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. Now they're trying to tell me I'm insane. I said, now, I've never been in a mental hospital. How can I come back from somewhere I haven't been? And they said, Cease, it's your negative attitude. They said, Cease, you are a negative thinker. And I was. Especially if I was doing something negative about you or in a discussion. You ever see people sitting around in Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon or Alateen trying to help somebody that's not there? And they say, did you hear? You know, isn't it awful? That's what I used to do. For hours I could do that. But all of a sudden they tell me you're a negative thinker. And I realized it was. And they said, cease, you need a manager. So I had an unmanageable life. In step one, step two, I found a manager. And I had such an unmanageable life. I was something like the negative barber. This guy slid into a barber chair one day and he said, like a haircut lasts me for 3 weeks. Barber said, why 3 weeks? And he said, well, I'm going on a holiday. Barber said, where are you going? And he says, I'm going to London, England. Barber says, you're not going to London, England. He said, I am. He said, you're not. Sit down. I wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, no, I've never been there, but I heard. Lousy place to go. He said, too many people, too many guys. The guy said, look, just cut my hair. If I don't like it there, I'm going on over to Paris. The barber says, you're not going to Paris. He said, I am. He said, you're not. Sit down. So I wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, I heard. Now, I've never been there, but I heard they really fleece the tourist over there. He said, look, if I don't like it there, he said, I'm going to Rome. The barber says, you're not going to Rome. He said, I am. He said, you're not. Sit down. He said, I wouldn't go there if I were you. I've never been there. He said, but I heard too many Catholics over there. He said, look, what does it matter? He says, I'm a Catholic. Yeah, but he said, I heard different kind of a Catholic over there. 3 years later, 3 months later, 3 weeks later, the guy comes back, slides into the barber's chair. The barber said, how was your trip? He said, it was good. He said, wasn't. He said, was. He said, wasn't. He says, you didn't go to London. He says, I did. He says, you did. He says, I did. He said, love to have stayed there long, but I wanted to get on to Paris. He says, you didn't go to Paris. He says, I did. He says, you did. He says, I did. He said, I'd love to have stayed there long, but wanted to get on to Rome. He says, you didn't go to Rome. He says, I did. He says, you did. He says, I did. And he said, you'll never believe what happened. He says, I got an audience with the Pope. He says, you didn't. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. And he says, you'll never believe it. He says, the Pope, I bent down to kiss the Pope's ring, and he says, you'll never believe what the Pope said. And the barber says, what? And he says, where the hell did you get that lousy haircut? And I was something like the negative barber. You know, I didn't know, but I heard. But anyway, I had this unmanageable life, and I found this manager, and that's how simple I had to keep it. And then it says that I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it. And in the steps, you hear many people say, as I understand them, but it says, I understood it. And I didn't care too much for this because I had a difficult time making decisions. And I know that some of you people have difficult time making decisions. I've been eating in the... where we go through that cafeteria, and I've been behind some of you. And especially Al-Anons. They just can't make it. That slows up all these roundups, you know, when we get behind the Al-Anons trying to make decisions in the cafeteria. But because we're afraid of making the wrong decision, and I was. I was afraid of making the wrong decision. As a matter of fact, tonight I was trying to decide whether I should go to the bathroom before I come up here. And right now I don't know whether I made the right decision or not. But we're afraid of making the wrong decision. I have a friend of mine who went over to Ireland. And he was walking down the street and the guy stuck a gun in his back. And he said, what are you? And the guy, he thought for a minute, he thought if I say I'm Catholic and he's Protestant, he'll shoot me. If I say I'm Protestant and he's Catholic, he'll shoot me. So he says, I'm Jewish. And the guy with the gun says, I'm the luckiest Arab in the whole wide world. So you see, sometimes we make the wrong decision, you know. I don't know whether you people know what a poacher is. I'm sure that some of you have heard what poachers are. They're people that shoot, you know, geese and ducks out of season without a license and go big game hunting everything without a license. And this old poacher, he used to fish whenever he wanted to fish without a license. They were trying to catch him for years. Finally, a new game warden came to town and he dressed up in old clothes and he went down and he makes friends with this old poacher. And the old poacher listened to him for a little while and finally he says, well, I'm going fishing. Do you want to come fishing? Said the game warden says, love to go fishing. So they went out there and the old poacher gets out in the middle of the lake, stopped the boat, opened a box, took out 2 sticks of dynamite, lit the 2 sticks of dynamite, threw the dynamite in the water, boom, up comes the fish. The old guy took out the net, filled the boat, and the old game warden pulls the badge out. And he said, I finally got you. And he's giving him a lecture. The old poacher never said a word. Reached over, picked out 2 more sticks of dynamite, lit them, handed them over to the old game warden. The game warden's sitting there with 2 lighted sticks of dynamite, and the old poacher says to him, look, buddy, do you want to fish or do you want to talk? He made a decision right back. And that's what they asked me to do. They asked me to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. So I had an unmanageable life. I phoned a manager. Step three, I had to keep it this simple. I had to say, look at God, I've done a lousy job of managing my life. How about you giving me a hand? That's how simple I had to keep it. And I take this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if some of you people think that this is some stupid propaganda that I'm bringing down from Canada, I want you to know I got this out of a book that I bought in the United States. And I read all about step three. And if anybody's having a difficult time, read step three. We're right at the end of where we read how it works, every meeting we've ever been to, probably. And there it says, you know, being convinced we're at step three. And then read what we're like. And it tells us. And I'm sure that you'll have no trouble turning that over. Because I didn't want to be that way. And I had to keep it simple. Talking about keeping things simple, a friend of mine back home has a ranch. And another friend said to him, how did you get the name of your ranch? And he says, well, I wanted to call it the Bar Q. My wife wanted to call it the Susie Q. My wife wanted to call it the Susie Q. My son wanted to call it the Bar Susie Q. And my daughter wanted to call it Susie Bar Q. So we called it the Bar Q, Susie Q, Susie Bar Q, Bar Susie Q. The guy said, that's a great name, but where are the cattle? And he said, none of them ever survived the branding, you know. So you see, it's important that I keep things simple because I may not survive the branding. And about this time, this program started to make sense because, you know, step one fitted into step two, step two into step three. And then they told me that when I finished this and we'd go to a meeting and Ernie would say this, are you ready to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand them? She understood them. And I said, fine, that's great. You know, I went along with it and did and studied the book with them. And boy, oh boy, all of a sudden this program started to make sense. They read how it works every meeting I ever went to. But how in the world I didn't catch on, I don't know. But then when we started to go through those steps as a group and we started to do them together, and I started to look at other people that were getting a shine in their eyes and laughter in their eyes because they were finding out what they belonged to and they were finding out how to do this program. And then they told us about step four. And you know, Earl Ernie was smart because he'd heard people say, I couldn't find a pencil and a paper. You know what Ernie did? He brought us a pencil and a paper. And he handed us all a pencil and a paper. And he says, tonight, when we go home, I want you to take step four. And we studied step four out of this beautiful book that I got from you Americans. And we studied it. And we studied step four. And on page 64 and 65, it taught me how to take step four. And I took that step four and I wrote it down. And I found out a lot of things wrong with me. But then a dear old fellow who, I hate to admit this, but he was Catholic. And he came along and I was taking my step four and I discussed it with him. And he said, well, see, that's fine. But he said, what about yourself? He said, look, you're a young man. You found Alcoholics Anonymous. You have a beautiful home. You have a really good job. You have a fine young family. You drive a nice automobile. You're healthy. Why don't you write those things down? And so I wrote them down. And after I'd taken step four, the next week we went on to step five. And you know, the only tough thing about step five, as far as I'm concerned, is step four. Because the moment I took step four, I wanted to take step five. Where it says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And a lot of people say to me, they say, I went and talked to another human being. That's not what step five said to me. Step five said to me, and I'm not saying what it said to you, and I'm not lecturing to you how to do it. I am sharing an experience with you that I had about these steps. Step five said to me, admit it to God. That I had to admit to God. And then I had to admit to me. And then I had to go and talk to another human being. And that's what I did. And then it told me in this beautiful big book that you people shared with us people in Canada. I took this beautiful big book, and it told me exactly what to do when I was finished step five. It said, take down your big book and go to a quiet place and read step six and seven, where it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and where it says humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And you know what was my problem? When I read that, and I read it alone, and I looked at it, and I was afraid of becoming too good too fast. Don't worry about that. If anybody is having that problem, don't worry about it. I'm privileged to do what I'm doing tonight almost every Saturday night somewhere. And I haven't met any saints as yet. Not even in Al-Anon, I haven't met any, you know? But it said to me that I had to be entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. and then humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Have you ever sat at a meeting and they're discussing what is the difference between shortcomings and defects of character? 2 hours we discuss it. And we go home and we still don't know the difference, and we don't know how to get rid of them. Bill Wilson, he said the reason he did that was because he didn't want to repeat himself. So really, they probably mean the same thing. But it says, are we entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character? And humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't stop gambling. I thought I'd be a better gambler. And it got me in more trouble. I used to swear a lot. And I mean swear a lot. There's a girl in our group that knew me when I was drinking, and she said I could clear out of a beer parlor just by walking in. And it wasn't that I was tough, it was because of my profanity. And so I had to ask God to remove the obsession for drinking or for gambling and for swearing. And tonight I hope that I haven't sworn from this podium. And the reason that I don't swear from a podium, and I try not to swear very much anywhere else, is the fact that one time in our town there was a gentleman that really needed Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard that he had gone to a meeting. And his wife was in my store, and I said, I hear some good things happen at your house. And she said, I hope so. She was going to Al-Anon. And I said, I heard he went to a meeting. And she said, yes. And I said, how did he enjoy it? And she said, I don't know. He came home, and I said, how was the meeting? And he said, it's a little confusing. Because he said, they prayed a little. They swore a lot. They prayed some more. And we had a cup of coffee and came home. And I hope that never, ever happens in my group. And I hope it never happens anywhere where I am if I am responsible for it. Because I think that I am supposed to change. I'm not telling you people that none of you are supposed to swear. That's your problem. I'm telling you, I'm sharing with you an experience that I had where I don't have to swear today to prove that I'm a man. That I don't have to gamble to prove something. I don't know what it was. Because I asked God to remove these. And then it says, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. I found out that to be humble, I had to get down on my knees. And I had a difficult time getting down on my knees because I hadn't been down on my knees since I'd been in Sunday school. And down on my grandma's knees when she taught me to pray. And I had a difficult time. And I can remember when Seth and Willard and I were delegates back in 58 and 59. To our General Service Conference in New York. There was a fellow there. He was from Chicago. His name was Shy Walker. Shy and I shared at a meeting one night at a big church in New York. And Shy told a story about how he came out of prison and how much, he so much wanted to stay sober, but how they told him he had to pray and how he couldn't get down on his knees. And he said he was working in construction and he wore high-top boots. And he said that one night he went home. And quite by accident, he kicked his boots underneath the bed. And he said the next morning, he got down on his knees to get his boots from under the bed. And he says, by golly, while I'm down here, I'm going to say a few words. And he did. And every night, he used to boot his boots under the bed. So that the next morning, he'd get down on his knees to get his boots and he'd say a few words. I don't know whether it works with high-top boots or not, because I didn't have any at that time. But I know it works with ordinary shoes, because I tried it. And if there's any definition for humility, as far as I am concerned, it would be the ability to stand and the willingness to kneel. And that's only my own definition, but that is what it means to me. Then they told me that I had to make another list of all the people I'd harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And I made that list. It was a continuation of step four. Because I didn't stop hurting people because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous is I admitted I was sick. And then I had to start doing things. And thank God for Ernie to lead me through those steps with the rest of the group. Because I took that step eight. I put my own name up top because I'd lost my self-respect in my own hometown. And I didn't know how to forgive myself. And step nine told me that I had to make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I went about making those amends. Thank God at our group, and thank God Ernie used to read page 83 and page 84. He used to read those beautiful promises all of the time. And when we came to step nine, I can remember that night where we found out what the promises really were. All of a sudden, they're right up there in front of me. And it says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. I share those with you. I know that all of you know what they are. But I share them with you because they meant so much to me. And I'll give anybody a guarantee, and I don't care whether you're in Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous or Alateen, if you will do those first 9 steps in sequence, you will find out what those promises mean. And if you will do them to your best of your ability, that you will find out what those promises are. And there's a little fella, and Willard knows him. Willard's been up to my country. A little fella that doesn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. But little Bill used to say, don't gyp yourselves. Get what's coming to you. And he wasn't sober nearly as long as I was. But I took Bill's... He shared that with us. He used to say it all of the time. And I know today that Bill so much wanted that, but he just couldn't get it. But he shared it with me and left it with me. And he shared it with a lot of other people. And I want what's coming to me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 10 told me that I had to continue to take a personal inventory. And when I was wrong, promptly admit it. Each and every night when I go to bed, it tells me in the big book what I have to do. It tells me that I have to take a look at myself. And I have to find out what kind of a day I've had. It tells me in the book exactly what to do, and I do it. And then it says, when we're wrong, promptly admit it. You know, when I was sober about 10 years, I forgot who I was and what I was and where I'd come from. And I stopped doing the maintenance steps, and I share this with you. Because I became Mr. Big Shot. In my business life, in my AA life, I never stopped going to meetings, but I went to meetings with an attitude something like this. You lucky people, here I am. You know, I was 10 years sober, and I share this because this just may happen to you. I had a fantastic job. I was a manager of the largest ladies' wear store in the province of Saskatchewan. I looked after the fur department for 5 stores, and I was working for the wealthiest man in our city. And I decided that he should be the second wealthiest man. And I went about trying to get some of those financial things and those material things. And I got some of them. But in my great struggle to get them, I lost some of those spiritual things that I had. And one day he called me into the office, and he and I were working in the same store, and it seemed that the store wasn't quite big enough for the two of us. And it seemed that he wasn't about to leave. And he fired the great C. Scorgel. And I walked out of that store with an attitude something like this, well, they won't last long now. You know? I hate to admit it, but they're still there. And they're still millionaires. And they're still wealthier than I am. And they're doing okay. A little cousin of mine came to see me at that time, and she came from the west coast of Canada, and she was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know today that she didn't just come. I know that God sent her. And I remember getting all dressed up and going down to see her. I was leaving to go to a roundup about 300-400 miles away. And I went down and I stood up in front of her in my big egotistical way and I said, well, kid, how do I look? And she just said these few words, and I'll share them with you. She said, you look really good on the outside, Cease. How are you really on the inside? And I drove to Flin Flon, Manitoba, Canada, to that roundup, and I thought about what Fern said, and I was with a dear old man by the name of Dave. And Dave knew that something was happening to me, and he didn't talk to me. He just let me think. I left there, and I went into Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and I spent a couple of days in a hotel room just talking to God. And I went back to my own hometown, and I started in business for myself. That's not important. I had to do something. And I started doing work the way that I should do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went back to AA with the right attitude that they needed, that I needed them, and that they didn't need me. All because that little gal shared that with me. For you see, it says when you're wrong, you promptly admit it. Did you ever have an argument about 7:30 in the morning? The next time you have one, it's probably at home if it's that time in the morning. Next time you have one, just halfway through the argument, say, I'm sorry. They don't know what to say. It's the most strange thing in the world. This has never happened before. You don't have to have those arguments. And the reason you don't have to have those arguments because step 11 said to me, sought through prayer and meditation. to improve my conscious contact with God as I understood it. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And I take this big book every morning, and I go into a little room that I have back home, and I read page 86 and 87 and 88. And it tells me exactly how to handle my day. And I read the prayer on page 63 and the prayer on page 76. And I read the last part of A Vision for You. And I may read the promises. I may read the other promises that they give you in chapter 7. And I read some other books. I may read Vincent Peale or Emmett Fox. Sometimes I even read the Bible. I know it's not conference-approved literature, but I read it anyway. You know. And it teaches me how to handle my day. And the reason that I have to do this is because one day I found myself many years ago going to work and having an argument with a man that was 1,300 miles west of me. And by the time I got downtown, I'm arguing out loud. And this is a difficult thing to do because you have to figure out what he's saying and he's not even there so you can answer it. And I was going to meet him at a fur convention in Montreal, and I got to my store and I wasn't finished the argument, and I drove around the block a couple times because I had a few more things to tell him. And I got to my store 8:45 in the morning, completely exhausted. You don't have to live that way. I don't do that anymore because I do my reading in the morning. And you see, it's important that I prepare myself to go out because you never know who's out there to get you. I mean, people don't know that we're sick. They don't know that I'm a sensitive guy. A customer can say unkind things to me. A bank manager can. A supplier can. Some of my staff can come in. You've got to be ready for people. I went to work one morning and I got a big write-up in a Saskatchewan business magazine. But the furrier most likely to succeed. And all of a sudden, the high interest rates come along and everything. And all of a sudden, my bank manager calls me in one morning and put me into receivership. That means that he took the business over. And the receivership's a bad thing to be in because anybody that's been in it doesn't want to talk about it. And anybody that hasn't been in it don't know anything about it. And so I didn't have too many people to talk to. But he left me as a manager, and I got out of it, and this is before receivership was you know, popular. I mean, there's a lot of people happening now. Now, if any of you are in it, come and see me, because I know how to get out of it. So you see, these people can be out there, and they can be out there to get you. And this is another story about an old poacher, and he used to do the same thing as the other old poacher in step three did. He did everything wrong. And there was a new game warden by the name of Ralph. Got into town, and he says, I'm going to catch that poacher. And by golly, he gets out there, and he beds himself down, you know, at night out in a bunch of hay outside this old guy's shack. And in the morning at 4 o'clock, the door opens, and he hears it opening, and the game warden's laying there, and he thinks, I got him now. And the old poacher poked his head out the door, and he says, you want some breakfast, Ralph? Ralph got up, and he goes inside. He's having some breakfast, and he said, how did you know I was out there? And the old poacher said, it didn't. But for the past 5 years, I open the door every morning and say, you want some breakfast, Ralph? You see, you can't take a chance. Because you never know who's going to be out there. And I want to share something really beautiful with you that happened one morning when I was doing my reading. We have our oldest daughter, Faye. She's just as fine girl, and we gave her everything that she could possibly want, love and material things and everything. And guess what she did? She married a Catholic, you know. An Italian one at that. They're the worst kind. And they used to live in Eastern Canada, and every time I was coming from somewhere like this, I would stop in to see her. And the first time that I went after, not the first time, but we had this little granddaughter, beautiful little thing. I can't understand why, but she's just a beautiful little girl. Catholic, but she's beautiful. And she was 3 years old, and she wanted to come home with Grandpa when I got there, and you know that's Grandpa's job, so she came home with me, and it's about 2,000 miles. She flew home with me, and next morning I was doing my reading in this little room, and she heard me up, and she came and knocked at the door. And Baby says, you can't go in there, honey, because Grandpa's doing his reading. And she said, well, I have something I want to tell him. And so I said, let her come in, and she came in, and I took her up on my knee and tried to explain what I was doing. And I said, what did you want to tell me, honey? And she says, I just wanted to tell you that I love you. And I said, I want you to know that I love you too. May not mean much to anybody out there. But it means a lot to this old hard rock that didn't know the meaning of love, didn't know how to give love because I didn't know how to receive it, and just didn't know anything about it. And I can say to that little gal that I love her. She has a little niece, or a little sister. The oldest one is Anna Maria, and the youngest one is Cella Luisa. And the little one, she jumps up on my knee whenever she wants and says, you know, that she loves me and jumps right back down. They go to a French Catholic school. That's not bad, but many times I have to drive them. And I come from a small town and everybody knows everybody else. And the sister said, good morning, Mr. Corgill, you know. And just recently, Anna was confirmed into the Catholic Church and Grandpa had to be there. And the priest made sure that everybody knew I was there. He said, good evening, Cecil, you know. But, you know, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, isn't it? You know, the live and let live and the open-mindedness and all of those things. You know, it's just so great. But I want to tell you about their little cousin. He's Protestant. He and I spent a lot of time together. As a matter of fact, he was at the International Conference with us in New Orleans. And he just had a great time. And I was privileged to be the trustee chairman of the International Conference, which I'm very proud of. And I had a good time. And Jason had a good time. Jason and I do a lot of things together. We go hiking. We just spend a lot of time together. He comes to roundups with me, and he's just a fine little fella. And one day we were getting the car washed, and we were right beside a Kentucky Fried Chicken place. And he said, let's pick up some chicken for Grandma. And I said, okay. And so he said, well, while we're at it, we might as well get some for ourselves, you know. So I don't know about him. He's getting pretty swift already. He's 8 years old. And so we got home, and we have little chairs and tables for the little grandchildren. And he asked me to sit at this little table with him. And we're sitting there, and we're eating the Kentucky Fried Chicken. And he said, you know what I want to be when I grow up, Grandpa? And I said, what do you want to be, Jason? And he said, I want to be a grandpa. And he said, I want to have a store, and I want to be the boss. And that may not mean much to you. But what it means to this old hard rock that sobered up at 27... that came to Alcoholics Anonymous without the ability to receive these compliments or this love, it means a great deal. But you see, that was probably the greatest compliment that I've ever received in my life. Because there's a little guy that wants to be like me. And isn't that fantastic? And then it said, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. The spiritual awakening to me certainly means just a personality change. Do you know that never do I ever want to say again that I have to go somewhere? Just imagine Thursday morning or Wednesday night. If I just said, oh, God, I have to go to South Carolina tomorrow. You'd be played out before you left. You know, it's a tough enough trip as it is. But I don't have to do that anymore because Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me. I told my group, I'm going to South Carolina, to Myrtle Beach. You know, told them in the right way and drove into Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which is almost 100 miles, caught a plane, flew down here. And I was a little tired, but I wasn't nearly as tired as if I'd have said I had to come here. And I try to do that in all of my life. In all of my living, I try to do that. And then it says we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. You know, we have a lot of people today running around trying to get people into Alcoholics Anonymous that don't even want to come. And I don't think we're having any problem getting people to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'll tell you, there's one thing that I've noticed. We are having problems keeping people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are already here. So tonight, if you see somebody standing or sitting or anything, put your arm around them and tell them that you love them and tell them that you want them and that you need them. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. Because there's somebody in this room tonight that needs help. They've got a football in their stomach and they don't know how to get it out. And maybe if some of us stop and spend a little time with them, maybe they're an Al-Anon, maybe they're an Alateen, or maybe they're an Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't matter. We're just a fellowship. And thank God for this beautiful fellowship. And then we said, we tried to carry this, or we practiced these principles in all our affairs. The principles are the principles I believe that I learned as I went through those steps in sequence. You know, and I like to practice the serenity prayer. I like to practice the slogans. Living a day at a time. After 30 years, I find that I still have to live it a day at a time. And I like to feel that I'm not quite as bad as I was yesterday. I'm a little bit better. But I always like to also pray that I'm not quite as good as I'm going to be tomorrow. Because this is what this program is all about. It's growth. And you know, we all know what the principles are. I heard a story about an Al-Anon lady. I guess she was from this area because she had a lot of money. And it seemed she couldn't get her old boy sobered up no how, and so she took him off on a trip. And she took him overseas, and he was drunk when she got in the plane, and he got drunker on the plane, and he got drunker when he got over there. And she took him out for a walk, and they came to one of these big wishing wells. And they stood out beside this wishing well, and they threw money in. And all of a sudden, this poor old drunk fell in, and he died. And you know what that sweet little Al-Anon gal said? This thing really works. I don't think that's practice the principles. We had another Al-Anon lady that I heard about that she got on a bus. And a lady sat down beside her, and finally the Al-Anon lady said, "Oh my God, I forgot to pay the bus driver." And the lady said, well, lady beside her said, "Well, if you're not, the bus driver's not worried about, what are you worried about?" She said, "Look, I just got into a program that demands rigorous honesty, and I have to pay the bus driver." And she went up, and she come back, and she said, "I told you, honesty paid off." She said, "I give him a dollar, and he give me change for five." I don't think that that's practicing the principles. But I think we all know what the principles are. And I think we're a bunch of lucky people, and today, the way the world is today, that we have a program. I think we're really fortunate people. And once again, I want to thank the committee for allowing me to be with you people tonight in South Carolina. I want to thank you, the audience, because you've been a fantastic audience, because you've been a listening audience. And it's so great because when an audience is listening, believe me, you make it a lot easier for people like me. And I want to thank you for that. And I want to thank God for giving me one more beautiful day to allow me to be with the people that I love to be with, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Al-Anon and Alateen. And there's a little town just outside of Omaha, Nebraska. It's a little town called Boys Town. And as you drive up to this little town, you see a statue. And it's a statue of one little boy carrying another little boy. And you can tell by the way that he's stooped over and by the sweat on his brow that he's having a very difficult time. But underneath are simple words, something like this. "No, Lord, he is not heavy, for he is my brother." And I would like to share a little prayer with you that my grandmother taught me, and one that I try to say every night. And that little prayer is, "Please, God, treat me tomorrow as I've treated everybody today." And I'm going to close this talk with something that helped me so much 20 years ago. And I hope it'll help you. Every one of you look real good on the outside tonight. How are you really on the inside? Thank you, and God bless you.